Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
Colin Powell knew how you were going to remember him.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Frozen in time at the United Nations on February 5th, 2003.
I cannot tell you everything that we know, but what I can share with you, when combined with what all of us have learned over the years, is deeply troubling. What you will
see is an accumulation. This is when he laid out the case for the Iraq War, the case that Saddam Hussein was harboring weapons of mass destruction.
My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources.
He spoke for over an hour that day.
These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.
And many of the things he said were wrong. Here is another way to remember him.
If you met him in person alone, I mean, he just seemed kind of like a hip guy.
Slate's Fred Kaplan covered the general when he was national security advisor under Reagan and when he became chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff a few years after that, and again when he was appointed Secretary of State. That's when Powell gave that fateful testimony at the UN.
I've met a lot of four-star generals in my time, and he was probably the most informal of them. You would have a normal conversation with him. He wasn't remotely stilted.
Powell was also loyal. Loyal enough that despite harboring deep doubts about the Iraq War, he allowed himself to become the invasion's chief salesman. Loyal enough that even after he left George W. Bush's cabinet, he refused to criticize it. For Fred, that kind of loyalty was equal parts admirable and frustrating.
And, you know, there were a couple of times when he got, you know, kind of pissed at me for certain things that I wrote. And most generals would either just not talk to you anymore or would act a lot more, you know, formal about it.
What would he say? Oh, come on.
Well, he wrote me an email once after I wrote an article for the Los Angeles Times in 2006 called Colin Powell Nowhere Man. Actually, do you want me to actually call this up so I can read it?
In this article, Fred called out Powell for remaining silent as the Iraq War descended into quagmire. He called Powell a prop in George W. Bush's photo ops. That is when the general tracked down Fred's contact information. And the thing is, even though Powell was pissed off, he was also funny.
Dear Mr. Kaplan, someone sent me a copy of your recent column blasting me. You must have been writing against the deadline since earlier criticisms were better argued. which is a mutual friend of ours told me that he's trying to win you over here. He wants you to engage with him. And I did. And then he wrote back saying, I wouldn't mind staying in touch and batting ideas back and forth.
I mean, he lamented that he would be remembered for this speech he gave in front of the UN Security Council.
That's right. No, he did regret it greatly, and which is why I, at the time, I was, and along with many other people, frustrated that he wasn't coming forth.
Do you think he should be remembered for it? Do you think that should be like the first paragraph of his obituary?
I don't look. He was in look first paragraph. I don't know. Certainly one of the top three.
Today on the show, remembering Colin Powell, soldier, general, and cautionary tale. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
By his own admission, General Colin Powell wasn't exactly academic. He was born in Harlem, raised by Jamaican immigrants, and all through school, he was just a C student.
I have my entire New York City Board of Education transcript from kindergarten through college. I wanted it when I was writing my first book. I wanted to see if my memory was correct. My God, it was. Straight C everywhere.
But what he lacked in academic rigor, he made up for in political know-how. When he entered the military, first through an ROTC program, something clicked.
I found something that I did well and something that I loved doing. And I found a group of youngsters like me who felt the same way. And so my whole life then was dedicated to ROTC and the military. And
I say to young kids, you don't have to be academically brilliant to excel first as a soldier and then as an operator. But okay, I mean, he was a hard worker and he was a very smart guy in ways that were valuable for what it means to be smart as a soldier and a political operator and a bureaucrat. You know, I was a reporter, a newspaper reporter, when he was the National Security Advisor and when he was chairman of the JCS. And I had some dealings with him even then. And he always struck me as very straightforward, very candid, very up on what he was talking about, but also in another way. I once saw him, he was National Security Advisor. I saw him speak to a group of school kids, like elementary school.
And this is way back, this is in the 80s, if he was National Security Advisor.
Yeah, that's right. And it was something to watch.
Why?
Well, because like he was introduced by these moronic Board of Education types who didn't know anything about him. And one of them called him a lieutenant colonel. He was lieutenant general at the time. So he gets up there and he goes, somebody said I'm a lieutenant colonel. Actually, I'm a lieutenant general. Generals give orders. So come on down. Come closer to the stage. I want to talk to you all. And then he would say things like, listen, you have to study hard. You have to learn how to speak properly. That's how you'll get ahead. You have to, you see the White House? I'm in that building in the West Wing. And he went on like, you know, just it was really quite inspirational.
It's funny you talk about his charisma because we were looking at this speech he gave at Howard University in the 90s. And I was struck in that, too. Like, he was funny.
Oh, yeah. No, very funny guy.
And just not what you think of as a military guy, so at ease with himself.
So the poor commencement speaker is left with the original problem of how long to speak. And I have a simple rule. I respond to audience reaction. If you are appreciative and applaud loudly very early on, you get a nice short speech. All right, let's get serious, huh?
And so happy to be at a historically Black institution, honestly. Like, he was just thrilled to be there.
Oh, he's never made any bones. He once said something like, you know, people say that I'm the first Black this or Black that. And, you know, some people would say, don't think of me that way. But no, he said, look, that is exactly how I want you to think of me. I'm very proud of this. When Jesse Jackson was running for president and he was working in the administration, Jackson would call him for advice on defense matters, and he talked with him. And he was on a talk show once, and somebody said, now Jackson thinks this about defense. And he said, look, you're trying to get me to criticize him, and I'm not going to do that. He made no bones about that being a very important part of his identity.
After becoming only the fourth Black four-star general, Powell was appointed National Security Advisor to Ronald Reagan. Then, under George H.W. Bush, he became the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That is where he articulated a particular perspective on how the U.S. should think about stepping into war. I've read that his view on the use of military force was deeply informed by the U.S. experience in Vietnam. Can you explain that a little bit, how that kind of set up his time advising the first Bush presidency?
Well, when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he was very much involved in writing the national strategy statement, basically. And he came up with these rules. Like, he had the five questions you should ask before you decide to go to war. And this became known as the Powell Doctrine. And what it basically was, it was this. It sounds common sense, but it wasn't at the time. It was, okay, before you go to war, first you should try everything else first.
That seems really basic, but I mean, I'm glad someone wrote it down.
And then even then, you should figure out what's the political objective here? You know, this objective should be really important, and B, you should think it through very clearly. And you should also think through very clearly whether military force will actually achieve this objective, and whether it can be achieved at a reasonable, at an acceptable cost and risk. And then, once you decide you're going to go to war, you should use overwhelming force. None of this, you know, sort of step-by-step escalation stuff or dipping your toe in it and so forth. You should use overwhelming force. And that became controversial later when, you know, we started doing counterinsurgency war, when we, you know, we don't go in with force, you go into, you know, affect the hearts and minds. And so it became very controversial, and in fact, for a little bit, out of fashion. But either way, it greatly influenced the debates over the next few decades of whether and how to use force.
He became known during the first Bush presidency, George H.W. Bush, for televised press conferences, and America kind of got to know him that way. Do you remember those?
Oh, sure.
And what do you remember of them?
Sure. Well, this was during the first Gulf War. And I was a newspaper reporter then. I was covering those press conferences. The Gulf War, this was, you know, pushing, you know, Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. And George H.W. Bush said, you know, this shall not stand. And so we deployed, you know, hundreds of thousands of troops to push him back out of Kuwait. And, you know, we hadn't seen any major war since Vietnam, and we lost that. It looked like we didn't know how to fight wars anymore. And nobody studied this stuff anymore. Nobody knew what any of this stuff meant. And so he was one of the main people who would go on at these Pentagon press conferences and go on Face the Nation and things like that too, explaining in very simple terms what was going on here.
Give me an example.
Well, I remember one time he said, you know, what we're going to do with Saddam's army, we're going to cut it off and then we're going to kill it.
Our strategy to go after this army is very, very simple. First, we're going to cut it off and then we're going to kill it. To cut it off, that began last week.
Things like that, which sound a bit crude, but hey, it's like, okay, no, that explains what we're doing here.
And he became really popular, right?
Powell, then when he came on these press conferences and people said, well, who is this guy? Then we got to know a bit more about him, that, you know, son of Jamaican immigrants, born and, you know, grew up in Harlem. But you became, wow, this is a real guy. He's come up from nowhere. That was when he sort of became a public figure.
So then when George H.W. Bush left office in the early 90s, what happened to Powell then?
Well, you know, he was a Republican, so he was out of power. And then he wrote a book called My American Journey, which was a huge bestseller. And that around the same time, he started thinking about running for president.
Why didn't he? It seems like he has a great platform. People like him.
Yeah, I remember watching him speak at a Republican convention. I forget which one, and thinking to myself, geez, you know, if this is what Republicans really thought, I might vote for one myself. but no, he didn't. The story I heard was that basically his wife told him, you are not going to run for president, because she was afraid that some lunatic would assassinate him.
Because he was Black.
Well, this is what everybody, look, let's remember, a lot of people were worried about this when Obama ran. It was like, oh, God. What's going to happen with this guy? So this is well before Obama. And so I don't know if that was the reason why. But I think even he acknowledged that that was one factor in why he decided not to run.
For a while there, Powell seemed to recede from the limelight. That is, until George W. Bush appointed him Secretary of State in early 2001.
He was known by everybody. When Bush appointed him as Secretary of State, I think he might have been confirmed 100-0. It was like, oh, great. This is great. He came in very confident and speaking as if he was going to run the show.
And he'd worked with George Bush's father, so he might have assumed he knew the ropes.
Yeah. And also, you know, when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Dick Cheney was Secretary of Defense, and by the way, a quite a different person from the Cheney that he later became.
He was in a cabinet full of people who were familiar, who he'd known for years, including Cheney, but their relationships had kind of eroded. What had happened?
Cheney installed as the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control John Bolton, whose real job it was to report back to Cheney everything that Powell was doing on arms control and to try to derail as much of it as possible.
When I read about this time in Powell's life, joining George Bush's administration right before 9/11, it's like middle school cafeteria shenanigans, but there's an army.
Why do you think this is so unusual?
But it seems crazy. People were out to get each other.
Well, they were out to get Powell, basically.
When we come back, Fred Kaplan explains why so many people in the George W. Bush administration were trying to undermine Colin Powell. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
After becoming Secretary of State, Colin Powell had a tough learning curve, mostly because his colleagues, Vice President Dick Cheney and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, were constantly elbowing him out of big decisions. After the terrorist attacks on 9/11, this dynamic got locked into place. It became clear Colin Powell had a different idea of what a war on terror should look like.
I mean, look, there was no discord on, for example, whether to go into Afghanistan and oust the Taliban and kill or capture Osama bin Laden. There was no disagreement on that.
Yeah, very early on, there was a Camp David meeting, right,
yeah,
where Powell said, oh, yeah, it's time to get Osama bin Laden, yeah, and here's
absolutely
how you do it.
But it didn't do what it did to others, which is make them, okay, we've got to just go make people hurt, and now is the time to go after Iraq because we wanted to go after them for a long time. He was more, you know, well, the idea is still to keep the world, but not to go crazy. But because everybody else was going in that direction, it did serve to isolate him even more.
Powell was reportedly meeting with, I believe, the foreign minister from the UK, basically his counterpart, mm-hmm, in the UK before the Iraq invasion. And they were both trying to figure out, like, how do we get our bosses not to do,
yeah,
this? What's it going to take? And it's just so stunning to look back on that now and think these two people knew, and they were quite powerful, but still they couldn't hold anything,
yeah,
back.
Because they weren't in control. They weren't really running the show. And, you know, there was, I think it might've been that meeting that his counterpart said, well, I understand that your president turns in at 10 o'clock and sleeps like a baby. And Powell said, oh, I sleep like a baby too. I wake up every 2 hours screaming.
So given how opposed Colin Powell was to the military going into Iraq, how did he end up being the chief salesperson for the war at the United Nations?
Well, see, that's another case of him being outmaneuvered. Cheney had the idea.
You call it a diabolical plan.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of support to do this. And so Cheney was the one who came up with the idea that Colin Powell should make the presentation to the UN Security Council.
Why?
Because people would believe Colin Powell, whereas they wouldn't believe Dick Cheney or just about anybody else in the administration. So Powell, and this is kind of the tragic part of the story. Powell, he was given a script and he goes, this is on bullshit. I'm not going to read this. And so he went to Langley, went to CIA headquarters, and he kind of buried himself there for days, going over all the intelligence. And he would say, okay, prove to me this. And they would prove to him that. And he came up with a speech, the speech that he gave, which, you know, made the case that Saddam Hussein does have weapons of mass destruction, was based on the evidence that he figured was at least plausible, and in some cases compelling. And what we've learned since is that George Tenet, who is the CIA director, who's, you know, the one goal, the CIA director at the time, this is before there was a director of national intelligence, so the Central Intelligence Agency was the Central Intelligence Agency. They briefed the president on threats, and the president was their main customer, if not their only customer. And if the president isn't paying attention to them, then they're nowhere. And so Tenet, his idea was, we've got to please the president. And it made, he was determined, mm-hmm, to show that there were weapons of mass destruction. And so there were analysts within the CIA who disagreed that Saddam did have weapons of mass destruction, but those analysts were not brought into the room.
So Powell never knew about them.
He was never made aware that this was not the only opinion, that there were some who thought otherwise. He was not introduced to the people who thought otherwise. And so he was bamboozled.
So deferring to the president and armed with incomplete information from the CIA, Colin Powell laid out the case for war, and it was convincing.
We believe Saddam Hussein knows what he did with it, and he has not come clean with the international community. We have evidence these weapons existed. What we don't have is evidence from Iraq that they have been destroyed or where they are. That is what we are still waiting for.
Do you remember watching the speech?
Oh, yeah, sure.
I remember it, too. It was like everything stopped to watch it.
Listen, I'll admit, I was against the war at that time. And for about 2 weeks after that speech, although still up to but before the actual invasion began, he convinced me that, yeah, okay, this seems like a reasonable thing to do. And I wrote a couple of Slate columns saying so. And then I realized, no, this doesn't make sense. And, you know, opposed the war again a little bit before it started. So I had a 2 week moment of conversion. And yeah, the conversion was because of this speech by Colin Powell. And a large part of that was because it was Colin Powell delivering it. And I didn't think that he would knowingly be telling lies or believing bullshit.
Do you ever think about what our timeline would look like if Colin Powell had just refused to endorse the war? Because Bush did ask him at one point, like, I need you. Are you with me on this?
Well, here's the thing. First of all, he wasn't the type to do that. And in fact, most military officers aren't. And, you know, the rule in military ethos is that you obey all legal orders. And as long as he didn't think this was illegal, then you salute and do it or you resign. I think that if he had resigned while he was still Secretary of State before the war started, I think it would have had an enormous impact.
The foreign minister in the UK said I would have resigned too.
Yeah, I think it would have affected a lot of the allies who were most of them reluctantly going in with us. It would have had a huge impact on domestic politics of this because he was still a universally admired and respected figure. You know, this is the tragedy of Colin Powell in that sense, that if he had said publicly what he was telling many people privately, yeah, it could have had a huge impact. Now, at the same time, again, I can't think of very many four-star generals who were in the position that he was in who would have done that.
It's funny because I think you're right that, you know, it wasn't in his nature. But the funny thing to me, when you read about the forces that were aligned against him in the Bush White House and cabinet, they already saw him as like some kind of resistance member.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he was trying not to be something that they already thought he was.
Yep.
And for that reason, that's why I think it's so challenging that he did not speak out and why... Yep. It's sympathetic. It's easy to see him as a tragic figure, but I feel like I can't.
Yeah, I think that's a fair view. You can be a good soldier and all that, but it's still, you know, not against the law or against even your ethos to come out opposed to something that you are known to be opposed to. So that was my problem and many people's problem with Colin.
How did he leave the administration? He was forced, right?
Well, there are many cases where it's unclear whether someone resigns or is fired. I think he knew his days were numbered. I mean, he waited till the end of the first term.
Part of what I think is interesting about looking back on Colin Powell's life right now is that I feel like in modern political discourse, we often talk about Trump as like a big change that happened, and as if Republicanism hadn't been changing for quite some time. Because I look at him and I see someone who, it seems like the party like changed underneath him while he was quite an important figure inside of it.
No, he was a moderate Republican, which is a species that doesn't really exist anymore in national politics. As I say, he spoke at some political convention, and I remember listening to him and thinking, well, if this was really what Republican Party stood for, I could see myself voting for a Republican now and then. And he was applauded at the convention, it's telling that, he endorsed Obama over his good friend, John McCain. He endorsed Obama again. He endorsed Hillary Clinton against Trump. Obviously, he endorsed Biden. He decried Trump on a few occasions. By the time, he was still a figure of great popularity and respect, but very little influence anymore. And I think part of that is because, as you say, the Republican Party left him. And the Democrats, a lot of people still remembered the UN speech and weren't terribly interested in what he had to say about foreign policy.
Fred, thank you so much for joining me.
Sure, thank you.
Fred Kaplan writes about war for Slate. And that is our show. What Next is produced by Mary Wilson, Daniel Hewitt, Davis Land, Elena Schwartz, and Carmel Delshad. Special shout out to the producers over at Slow Burn for their help with today's episode. If you have not listened to their most recent season on the lead up to the Iraq War, check it out right now. You're like in your podcast app. Just click over. Allison Benedict is the executive editor for Slate. Alicia Montgomery is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. And I am Mary Harris. You can see what I'm up to when I am not recording this show over on Twitter. I'm at Mary's Desk. In the meantime, I'll catch you back here tomorrow.